Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we are here to do the season four wrap up. We've talked about all 11 episodes, and now you guys and gals get to say something. This is going to be, I think, mostly a feedback episode because I'll be honest, I have thought more about the season, but my opinions have not changed. I feel like we talked a fair bit last episode about our thoughts on the season, and they were pretty fresh at the time. But like I said, it hasn't evolved much since then.
Yeah, I kind of agree. It's time to take the season out to a cornfield. We dug a big hole for it.
Wow. Okay.
Give it the treatment. But I felt the same way. Like there was two big interviews, but not like a full deconstruction like there's been in seasons past. That was in the Hollywood Reporter and IndieWire. We talked about that last week. I kind of waited for another one to come out, another one, you know, maybe a longer form kind of podcast or something. I didn't see one. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've been thinking, I'm like, I was kind of worried about how this wrap up would take place. But then I opened up the feedback and oh, my gosh, we got quite a lot of thoughtful takes that I think are going to springboard us onto most of the conversations we want to have anyway. So
cool.
Let's see what people have to say. These were, of course, submitted by sending an email to fargo@baldmove.com. Also, I will say that since this is the last time we're going to be talking to our Fargo folks, if you like kind of our coverage of Fargo, some of the more serious stuff we do, I highly recommend following Bald Move Prestige. Mm-hmm. Because that's the feed where we do stuff like Fargo. If you want to, you're not maybe a fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe or Game of Thrones or some of the space shit or other stuff, but you like quality entertainment, check out Bald Move Prestige. There's a couple goodies coming out this month. We're going to be doing, what is it, a 20-year anniversary of Tom Hanks?
Castaway, yeah.
Castaway, thank you. Wilson. Uh-huh. And we've done, if you like gang stuff, boy, we had a lot of gang stuff. Isn't just in the last like 2 months on Bald Move Prestige, Casino, Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. We did The Irishman. So like if you're kind of into this, I do recommend checking out Bald Move Prestige if you want to kind of stay plugged into the Bald Move community through the long winter wait for new Fargo. Because it does seem like we are going to get new Fargo. I haven't heard about FX renewing it, but... But this is the first time, and I think in a season or two, the holiday came. Like, yeah, actually, I have some ideas for season five. Mm-hmm. So be on the lookout for that. Anyway, fargo@baldmove.com. Matt M. used that ability to send in the following piece of feedback. The last scene is to let us know that Satchel is Mike Milligan, to surprise of no one. But why? Yes, they show him reading How to Win Friends and Influence People, but it's a long ways away from the quiet boy that Satchel was to the outgoing killer that Mike Milligan will become. Why did he change his name? My wife thinks it's because his father traded him, but I think that's pretty thin. I think they... So let's talk about... Well, no, actually, let's keep going on Matt's thoughts. He goes, I think they played the death of Loy wrong. Satchel comes across Zalmair with a bloody knife and telling him, shh, and then goes running off. Satchel turns and sees his father dead and does nothing. The boy just spent 4 weeks or more walking home to a father that was so happy to see him, and he does nothing. He told those rednecks in the truck that this was his world, and it would be time to explain that to Zalmair, I would think. We've seen the shotgun next to the front door. That should have been Mike Milligan persona coming out of to party. No one would be taking anything away from him ever again. I understand having a preteen gunning down a woman could perhaps be difficult to show, but it's definitely been better than what we got, him just staring into his father's eye. Thoughts on that? I got a few, but I'm curious to see what you thought about that kind of herky-jerky evolution of Satchel into Mike Milligan.
Yeah, I think it's a fair criticism, although I think the real problem here is not necessarily the way that they handled the encounter with Zalmair. It's more the encounter with those rednecks on the road. It was like foot on the gas, Mike Milligan is here. And which is why I feel like they should have maybe left it at that, because then we could have seen him walking off, you know, into the sunset and becoming Mike Milligan.
Right.
The Zalmair thing, yeah, kind of maybe reverses that a little bit. I mean, you're coming at it from the angle of like, oh, he should have done more to So here's the thing. I don't think that he feels like Loy is his father. Like, yeah, he's his father technically, but he's never really known him. Like, he's been with these Italians for years now. Rabbi Milligan is the one who's really been his father through this. And I
has
feel
it
like
been, cause I, has it been years? Because I thought that this whole the whole thing took place in a span of a year.
Does it?
Yeah, it starts in 50 and ends in 50, the spring of 51.
They trade him off in 50?
Yeah.
Okay.
You
might be right. But you look at how Loy treated the rest of his family, right? And he's not really the father that's there all the time. He's more concerned with about accumulating that power. And, you know, his family clearly takes a second, a backseat in his life. So I could get the sense that, like, Rabbi Milligan, having sort of tutored him for the last year, has become more like a father to him. And so him staring into his eyes and doing not a whole lot sort of makes a little bit of sense there to me.
I think it's also it's really tricky to show a child turning into a killer, right?
Sure.
And how, like, Satchel on the road walking back from liberal Kansas to Kansas City had to be hard, you know, because he was being fucked with and he was vulnerable. And I feel like it's a tale of he gets home, sets his gun on his bed, his father comes and loves him, his mother comes and loves him, his brothers and sisters are there. Like, now it's like when you get into that situation, like you've been in a fight or flight survival response situation, and you start to relax and like, okay, I don't have to be this hard. I can be, you know, and then this happens to you. Like, to me, it's like, it's just another explanation of Mike Milligan. Like, you know, like, I didn't need Satchel to transform into Mike Milligan. I needed Satchel to be put on a trajectory where I can see him 20 years in the future. Oh, yes, that's Mike Milligan. And I felt like the season definitely did that. In fact, it's almost like you can see this as like a, you know, to the extent that he might be tempted to think his dad's way of doing things, be decent and right and never be underhanded and always keep your word and all that kind of stuff. A repudiation of that. Like, my dad did everything, quote unquote, right, the way a gangster's supposed to, and he still got kicked in the teeth. So I'm going to color a little bit outside the lines. And you see a little bit of that with his, like, treachery with Joe Bulo in season two. I don't think Holly gives a fuck about having a 12-year-old blow somebody's head off, you know? Like, I don't think it's that kind of problem. It's more of just like, yeah, how can I actually make this story about this child be even more tragic? I don't know. It would have been badass for him to shoot Zalmair, but would it have been as emotionally effective? And would it have been as good an end? Because it's not just the birth of Mike Milligan, although it's weird because I feel like Mike Milligan had like three different births this season, you know, when he got taken away from his family, when Rabbi Milligan left him, and then when his father finally leaves him.
That trajectory for sure was there, like you're talking about, because you can see, like, okay, maybe Rabbi Milligan was more of a father to him, maybe he was less of a father to him, but he was certainly a father figure, and
certainly
that guy, you know, was sort of promising him things, I guess, like that he'd have like a certain amount of protection, and then he just, and you know, like, hey, every time I leave, I'm going to tell you, like, I'm dead or I'm in jail, whatever. And then the last time he leaves, he doesn't say that, and there's something there, and I don't want to read too much into it because like he's told him that over and over again so many times that Satchel knows he's dead or in jail. But yeah, there's a significance to him not saying that the last time and sort of being a weird kind of abandonment, sort of thing with Satchel. But then he goes home, and I feel like, I don't even know if he recognizes this as home. Does he? Like, he goes there, so he has some attachment to it. It's like, how much attachment does he actually have to the family who traded him off?
Especially when you're talking like a 10 to 12 year old, like that's a year.
That's a lot
like
of
I've
time.
Been thinking about in terms of my son. He's 14 and he's lived in this pandemic for a year. That's a long chunk of your time. It's the equivalent of me doing it for 6 or 7 years, you know, in terms of lifespan and whatnot. So That's a, yeah, you got kids view time a lot different than adults do. That's a good point.
And that emotional effect it would have on a kid is much more severe too.
Right.
The emotional maturity is not there to understand, okay, well, this is something that, you know, had to be done and blah, blah, blah. It's all just like, how does it feel?
Yeah. And you can kind of, I feel like there's also Lemuel there to kind of understand the dynamic of the family. It's not that like Loy Kanan didn't love his kids. It's just that as you get, as like, you know, Lemuel got older and got to know more about the world, he recognized that the family is not the number one thing.
Right.
You know, the accumulation of power. I mean, I think in Loy's mind, it's, you know, we had this discussion the other day about Breaking Bad, you know, like when did Walt stop doing things because he's dying of cancer and want to protect his family and start doing things because fuck yeah, I like being a crime boss. Mm-hmm. I think that stuff probably, like if you ask Loy, the reason he's doing all these things is to protect his family.
Right.
You know, the only way we can protect your family in this fucking America is to, you know, tool up, muscle up, get organized, get your money and, you know, protect your community, protect yourself. But I imagine, you know, being Lemuel and Satchel, that gets to be kind of lonely. And it also exposes kind of hypocrisy. It's like, oh, it's family first, family thirst. But like, it seems like it's you getting all the power and the money and calling all the shots and us in the danger. And
yeah.
So, yeah. It's,
but then
it's,
there's sort of tough. A minor happy ending with the family. So I don't know. Like, they lose their father, but also everybody's back together. It's Christmas. They're all around and playing. Like, the note it leaves it on is not entirely sour, which is a little weird.
I mean, yeah, it's a death and fun. But like, so I want to move on to the next email because it actually talks about this. So a lot of people have, in the last week, to my amazement, watched all of season two to kind of get that, like,
oh,
you know,
Jesus,
Mike Milligan connection. Justin came back and said, upon completion of season four, I went back to watch all the Mike Milligan scenes. There's been at least three people tell me this, too.
Okay.
From season two, not this particular thing, but they went back and watched season two. And happened to stumble across a perspective clue as to what life was like for Satchel after witnessing the death of his father in 1951. And a scene where Mike sits and stares pensively at the severed head of Joe Pulo, he remarks, "She was a true gloom, my mother. We used to eat in the dark." Then he shares for a laugh, he wrote on her tombstone, "Here lies Barbara Milligan, happy till the end." So this implies that after the death of Loy and the collapse of the Black Mafia's hold on the criminal marketplace of Kansas City, they likely left town and changed their names. Buell opting for Barbara and Satchel opting for Mike. I think that's a reasonable, you know, explanation other than just Mike telling stories.
Well, that's where I was going to go. Yeah, this could be just talk.
Yeah, but it also could be, you know, that Buell, Barbara, I can see that too. So far, I haven't seen Mike mention any of his siblings, but I can't believe that Holly would just overlook that if Milligan was a catalyst for season four story. Very excited to see how you guys run with this, Jim. I think that is very interesting. Like, if you take him at his word and that his family had to go into hiding, which seems reasonable, based on how things were at the end of the season, that, like, it's not like the Italian mafia wasn't comfortable with supplanting somebody that's been, you know, perhaps truculent with someone who's a little bit more pliable. And, you know, the Cannons had to go. It is interesting that his mom turned into this a true gloom character. That it, you know, like, a contrary to your expectation, the family had a relative a happy ending.
Right.
That this, you know, it's like it's kind of like Skyler. You imagine Skyler with Walt Jr. And shit, I've already forgot the baby's name. His daughter.
Shit.
Oh, man. The memory banks were calling for that. And anyway, Skyler, the baby, and Walt Jr., like, could you just, I wonder if you could describe a Skyler as a true gloom for the next 5 to 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
They definitely cast a pall on that happy family sitting.
Yeah. No, that could be totally right on.
Yeah. And, like, you know, that could be, and who knows what that would, you know, feed into the Mike Milligan machine. The fact that you had this dynamic father that was killed young, and maybe you see him as a little corny or naive, but then your mom is just doom and gloom thing. And none of those. So, like, the idea that then Mike would throw himself into another criminal organization and try to work harder and smarter and get ahead and get it sounds like it'd be, I don't know if it's satisfying is the word I'd use as a research, but it sounds like it really connects. And Holly said one of the things he really wants to do in season five is like a future Mike Milligan, like, you know, Mike Milligan in the 90s or early 2000s. And that would be a fascinating bookend to this kind of opera.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It also breaks, like, it's starting to, Fargo's starting to feel a little too connected-y, you know?
A little bit, yeah. As long as they can make it to where you don't need to have watched the previous Mike Milligan stories to enjoy that one, that's fine.
And I think that's been true of all. Like, you didn't need to know. In fact, I got one emailer that was, like, confused why we didn't make a bigger deal about the reveal of Satchel as Mike Milligan. I'm like, I was worried. That the thing is that we've been talking about it kind of like in a... It's like, well, it's like, it's not a big, it's just a nice connection that when it finally came, I felt like redundant to point out that, like, oh yeah, also Satchel's Mike Milligan, you know, what the fuck?
Here's the thing though. I'm not sure I would have made that connection had I not been doing the research on the internet where people figured that out day one, like literally episode one, people were like, Satchel is Mike Milligan, boom. Called it. And Noah Hawley himself says it was never meant to be a secret. I don't know how much he's bullshitting because, you know, after the fact, like,
yeah,
oh, people figured it out. Shit, I guess I wasn't as clever as I thought. Let's just say, you know, that it was never a secret.
If you're a fan of Fargo, like, it's like that you'd maybe watch a season again every couple of years or so. Like, Mike Milligan is like a central figure that I feel like that the just a Rabbi Milligan and the black white kid swap, that the juices would have flown pretty freely. But
maybe. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that people pointed out that I wouldn't have caught on to.
Sure.
So I can see it. But yeah, it was never really, according to Hawley, meant to be a secret or a big reveal.
Yeah.
And like you said, we've been talking about it so long in this season that it didn't feel like a huge reveal that we needed to talk a lot about at the end of this season.
I do suspect that, like, some of the stuff we talk about in the feedback section, and I know statistically that, like, a third of the audience just doesn't listen to the feedback. You know, we got the listening statistics. So, you know, if you're one of those, you miss a lot of good stuff, a lot of good connective discussion and stuff.
Well, they're not listening right now to this mostly all feedback episode.
That's true. So. Oh, this is all feedback. Click.
Yeah.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Anyway, moving on to Louis B. said, nice work on the Fargo podcast. Thank you. Appreciate Thanks. It. I agree with everything you said about the finale and the series in general. But in defense of Bryan Cranston, what he has done since he left Breaking Bad, won 2 Tony Awards.
Yeah, Tony's Tony's don't count to me. I don't care about Tony's.
Okay.
You can win 50 Tonys. Right. What have you done on TV? What have you done in movies?
It's all about the Jimmys of this guy. He just fucked the Tonys.
Yeah, the Baldies. How many Baldies have you won, Mr. Cranston?
I don't think he was part of the Baldy era, but he certainly would have won a few if we'd have done it.
Yeah.
But he played LBJ in a movie. Which,
sure. I saw that one.
Yep. He was nominated for an Oscar in Trumbo. He did a great job in that movie. I want to watch this movie. I just watched Mank, which was the Gary Oldman playing this, like, you know, Red Scare era Hollywood writer. It sounds like Trumbo is exactly the same kind of lane. And I found Mank really fascinating. So I need to go back and watch that one. He made a few other movies that were fair. I'd say he's done well after playing such an iconic figure. I think that the problem is Bryan Cranston is a very good character actor, and he had this one, you know, he had this really starring, like sensational starring role. But it's like, if he goes back to having like a Gary Oldman career for the rest of his life, that's a pretty fucking good career. Speaking of Mank,
it is,
you know,
yeah, but it's not high profile. I'm looking for stuff that like really breaks out into the mass audience, and millions of people are watching and talking about, and you know, in the way that millions of people watched and talked about Breaking Bad, and you know, he hasn't done that, and that's fine. You know, he's got a great career. It's just
he needs a Zorg.
I love Bryan Cranston, and I want to see him in more stuff that I'm actively watching.
He needs a Zorg from Fifth Element type of role.
The
father of the Godzilla guy didn't quite cut it. He needs a
maybe a Mega Zorg.
Yeah,
he was in that Power Rangers movie.
Was he really?
Yeah, he played a. What's the computer? What's that computer? Personality.
Jesus.
He played that.
Yeah, the Vix Vapor Mist kind of looking dude. Yeah. He's also. I mean, if we want to run down, he was in Driver. Really amazing bit role in Driver.
Yep. Oh, in a scene I can hardly even watch.
It's one of the all time, you know, fucking chilling screen deaths.
Yeah.
He was also in something else that. Shit.
He's recently in a movie about a crooked judge trying to get his son off.
Yeah, that just came out, just dropped. Yeah,
I haven't seen it yet.
So he's had a lot of good character actor moments. I don't think he's going to be, you know, probably a leading man that kind of thing. But he's had a fine career. I don't know. This is the Fargo
podcast. Go back to television, Cranston. Like, forget your Tony. You won all the Tonys, right? You've done enough with the Tonys. Get back to some. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe go for a Grammy and then come back to television and get another leading role.
Tell me that you don't want to see Bryan Cranston cast in a B-tier part in next season of Fargo.
Yes. Perfect.
Like some kind of Nick Offerman type kind of oddball weirdo, like, you know, very likable, memorable quotes. Like he crushed that. I was trying to bring it back to Fargo. We need to bring Cranston back for the first time to Fargo.
You had the small pond where you were the big fish. Come on back. The water's fine.
Seb is the next one up. They say, this may be a bit of an obvious point, but something that I think stopped this latest season of Fargo feeling properly Fargo-ish is that the other seasons began with a murder, and the unraveling of an inexperienced criminal as individual seasons progress really helped give a good skeletal structure where the stakes get raised along with their paranoia. I think this lack of structure was noticeable in the newest season, as it had a lot of good ideas, but no solid connections. I agree. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that that's why a lot of people are kind of struggling and why it isn't, because it is this, it had a very un-Fargo-ish structure.
Yeah, there is the murder of Donatello, but it doesn't, it's not that incompetent. It's not that like almost accidental murder or the murder of passion by an amateur. It's,
if it was that, it would have been about the little Boy Scout kid that actually accidentally shot him, and him being hunted down by the, why is this happening to me? Like, but obviously that's not how it went. It wasn't a bad season to continue. It just didn't feel much like Fargo to me.
Yeah.
The sillier aspects did not gel with the serious ones in an organic way, the way they have in previous seasons. And I think part of it is that we didn't have a proper, another big key difference, point of view police character. I know other people have pointed it out, and Seb's going to do here too. Although we had Weff, he did not meet the archetype of the downtrodden officer fighting against a corrupt or incompetent system as we saw in previous seasons. Weff seems more like a foil to the character that would have been there, and Deffy, although he had his moments, had a very fleeting minor antagonist just there to stir things up, really. I think that's another, those are two key, it wasn't like a relative innocence first brush with the darkness of murder.
Yeah.
And, you know, the cover up and all that that kept embroiling and meshing and complicating things. I mean, that's what drove the original Fargo and all the other previous Fargo seasons.
No, you're right. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but that seems to be the quintessential Fargo device that works so well.
And then paired that with a police officer investigating, it always gives that nice through threads with, people being able to make that connection back to like, oh, it's about Gloria, or oh, it's about, you know, Molly or Molly's dad, you know?
We're seeing, you know, the effects of getting farther away from the Fargo-ness of Fargo and more into like Holly making this his own thing. You know, because he's still doing Cohen stuff, right? But it's a broader palette, and it's also now he maybe feels confident enough to do something that is his own, something he's, you know, been thinking about and wants to make a statement on in these Fargo seasons. I guess this can be the place for that, but you're right. In those moments, it doesn't feel as much like Fargo.
Totally agreed. And Seb wraps up by saying, I hope you are both staying well in these difficult times, and thank you for continuing to provide us great commentary to enhance our films and TV shows. Have a wonderful Christmas and try to take some proper time off. Thank you. Merry Christmas to you. Yeah. And we are going to, I think next week is our last full working week, and then we'll have 2 weeks off to enjoy the Yule time and then get back to it in the new year. Tommy from North Carolina, I managed to agree with you both, as I usually do. Holly did indeed swing for the fence, but for every home run, there's plenty more strikeouts, and in the end, there just wasn't enough to watch the story beautifully collapse into itself all on its own. There's no glorious blaze at sunset, but a lot of people turned out and worked their asses off because the sets, the costume design, the cast, the direction, the camera work were all superb. I'll echo that. Sometimes we don't spend enough time praising the amazing things of Fargo because, the cinematography.
I take a little bit of umbrage with the idea that the cast was perfect, but okay. The rest of that, it is. It does look great and sound great. And
you're right. There was a few casting misfires, and maybe it's one of those things that's like if the other some. I don't know. We're going to eventually get around to the writing because I think that's the thing. It's like the stew just didn't quite come together this year. Individual moments of brilliance and everybody's, you know, had clean consciousness and full hearts working on the project. It just, you know, sometimes things are messy, like racial relations in America.
Mm-hmm.
With Holly, I'm always down for the ride no matter where we're going. I'd eat this for every supper with two spoons. By the way, I'm a 2-3-1 branch of the Fargo family, waiting to see where 4 will eventually settle. What are you? So this is a good point to kind of like contextualize, because I think I'm the rare 3-1-2.
Ooh, yeah.
I think the Fargo season was the best. Vargo.
Vargo.
And then I really liked the first one. And then the second one, I kind of probably need to go back and rewatch that because in my mind, it was just a big disappointment with the UFO that sticks out there. And I don't know if that's right. Fair. But 3-1-2 and 4, I think for a lot of the reasons Seb mentioned, I have a hard time placing it. It's like, hey, you got Star Wars, A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, Star Trek, The Voyage Home, and then Return of the Jedi. Which is your favorite Star film? Like, well, one of those things isn't like the others at all. Yeah. Like, you know?
No, that's fair. I feel like I'm a 1-3-2-4 maybe. I don't know. There are things about 2 that I really like. The Meth Damon, Kirsten Dunst stuff. All that stuff I really like. The stuff with what's his name? Patrick I can't remember his
Warburton.
Name. Warburton. But all Wilson. Lou Salverson. Yeah, Patrick Wilson. All that stuff I really like. It's just like, did the stuff with the Gerhardts work out exactly as I wanted it to? I don't know. It's some of it's good, but then there's the UFO stuff.
Hansi, man, is so good.
Hansi's great. Yeah, it's and you know Mike Milligan obviously can't be overlooked.
Yeah, but King Woodbine is really amazing.
I wonder if I'm not just a 1-2-3-4 guy. Just yeah. Straight up.
That's season 2 cast is amazing. It introduced me to Rachel Keller, which I then went on to really enjoy in Legion. It's such a great cast, but mm-hmm. it's very hard because like when I say I'm a 3-1-2 guy, there's really small shades that you know that separate those. And if it wasn't like you know if VM Varga wasn't in season 3, I think it would, you know, probably be my least favorite, but he's, I think, my favorite Fargo villain. So he kind of like gets up to the top with a bullet. But yeah, it's tough. Tommy ends with, as far as the country's grand design, there's an establishment nearby up in the county seat next to an ancient airstrip that we call simply the pig. And they'll smoke you a whole hog if you ask real nice with some chicken while they're at it. And not just to show off, and that whole hog is on the pit right now cooking, and while it's true that looking ain't cooking, one must still regard it, must patiently, lovingly tend to it from beginning to end. We're just not there yet, but that shit's going to be so good when it's finally ready, and all will be welcomed. P.S. B.Y.O.B. Amen. Amen, brother. I do hope we can all have that countrywide barbecue one of these days. Jared, thought you might be interested in checking out this short 20-minute podcast from our local KC, Kansas City NPR podcast about the show. What the show got right and wrong about Kansas City. Love the coverage. I'll include this link in the show notes. Or I guess Jim will, because I'll send it to him. But it is pretty good. It's interesting because it's this guy who's an expert in Kansas City mafia, which is a real whole thing, like a whole history. Oh, yeah. Goes into, like, you know, kind of bemoaning the fact that Kansas City's never got its moment to shine in the great gangster films. It's always like an add-on of like Casino, right? Oh, yeah, there's sure. the Kansas City mafia and all that kind of stuff. Versus the guy who was the historical consultant for Fargo season 4, saying like, look, we weren't telling that story, but the cars were cool. And I tried to make the buildings look as Kansas City as I could, even though it was like, I think it was in a suburb of Chicago. I thought it was an interesting conversation. I said it's only 20 minutes long. So check it out if you're looking for more Fargo. But yeah, this is not even remotely historically accurate. None of this stuff actually happened for a quote unquote true story.
Yeah.
I don't know. People have figured out that whole thing with Fargo. It's bullshit. Uh-huh. It's what we call a framing device. But Renan says, first of all, thank you so much for the amazing podcast this season. Well, thank you. It's not the best Fargo we've received, but I found it quite enjoyable, and your podcast helped bring a lot of meaning and insight. Truthfully, nothing could have lived up to the sky-high anticipation I had, and working on set as a background actor, ooh, inside information, throughout the season really kicked into high gear my desire to see how the final product looked and turned out post-edit. I attempted to shout your episodes, recaps, and send people your way on several Facebook groups as well, particularly after an episode 9 wrap-up and your insights into the political meanings of The Wizard of Oz, which I found fascinating. And
I tried.
I appreciate the sweat equity there, and a lot of people did. Cool. And we appreciate you sharing that. You know, that's how we grow here. It's we don't do any marketing. It's all word of mouth and algorithms. So thanks for that. My question for the last episode is this: where did you get the info about Bokeem Woodbine and Brad Mann, the Kitchen Brother, coming back and doing reshoots? I've read and watched nearly every interview with Noah Hawley, and every indication I've seen is that this was taken from season 2 footage. Someone on one of the Facebook groups insists that it's from after the Undertaker was killed on the way to meet Ed, the butcher of La Verge. I forget how to pronounce that. Maybe an outtake from a slightly different angle, but of that shooting date. Any insight on this or where you got that info that Bakim was brought back for this or other scenes that weren't used? I took this information from the Hollywood Reporter interview. It's the November 29th, 2020 by Josh Winger entitled Fargo Season 4 Finale, How That Final Twist Came to Life. And he asked a question, Josh did you play around with other versions of the final scene of Bakim Woodbine? And Holly said, there were other versions. There was a version where after Loy's death, we jumped forward in time to the 90s and we see Bakim now as part of this corporate engine, the Kansas City Mafia. When we last saw him in season 2, we left him in an office with a typewriter. It's going to be this idea that he prospered in that business on some level, but now we understood his past. We would understand that he was passing in order to do it. The truth is, we filmed a version of that, and it didn't work as far as I could felt. It felt like we got 30 minutes into the finale, and then we jump into a whole new story where you're going to have to watch multiple scenes. It didn't feel like a satisfying ending. It in fact, started a whole other story. I wondered if we needed to reshoot things. We talked about doing an LA reshoot with new scenes written. So, I mean, this implies to me that there was a Fargo-ish episode length, 45 to 50 minutes of additional 15 to 20 minutes of Bakim Woodbine being Mike Milligan that they actually did film. They said that they did film it. It was multiple scenes. So somewhere, unless Holly's lying, there is a roll of film of Bakim doing this stuff. And I thought, as far as whether the stuff that actually got in the episode is old or new, I thought Bakim looked a little bit slightly heavier in the face.
Well, it's like definitely old. Like one of the interviews I read with Holly, he was specifically asked about the footage that made it into the show. And about the cuts that I mentioned under Kitchen Brothers' eye, and asked, does this mean that it takes place after the events of season 2? And he's like, well, that is, you know, old footage, and one of the, you know, that's footage from season 2, and one of the great things about this is that you can kind of place it wherever you want. And these these stories not being explicitly connected very often means like, but to me, like it happens after season 2. But he does say in that interview that this is old footage from season 2 that they repurposed for this. So,
okay.
Yeah, they must have cut just everything they shot in those reshoots.
And it makes sense if it's all set in the 90s that
you wouldn't use the same
stuff. You wouldn't use that. So it's like it seems like it's both things are true. That last scene is old footage of him, but there is entire scene shot in of a 1990 Bakim Woodbine in his new position in Kansas City, and that stuff exists somewhere, whether we're, you know, what, maybe it'll be on the DVD or Blu-ray for season 4, but it seems like both things are true. Because I got afraid when you sent that in, I'm like, oh shit, did I misspeak? But no, he did say that they shot it. They filmed a version of this with several scenes. So, and it's in the True Hollywood, the Hollywood Reporter, not the True Hollywood. I think that everything they report on is factual. At the beginning of every article, it's like, this is a true story.
Right, so
who knows? Eric. Hey, guys. Just became a Bald Move Premium member and appreciate everything you do. Hey.
Thank you.
Like hearing that. Top-of-the-line content adds a lot to shows I enjoy. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. As for the Fargo Season 4, I agree wholeheartedly with your overall view that it was entertaining but messy. Typically of Fargo, the aesthetics were great and handled incredibly well. Costumes, scenery, decor, etc. Always compelling on this show, and season 4 is no different, but the storylines felt disappointingly short of the visual stimulation the season provided. That said, I had two thoughts I wanted to get your input on, one broad and one more narrow. First up, broadly speaking, I think one of you expressed last week the show just felt off a bit more than it could, or it bit off a bit more than it can chew this season. The theme of the plight of minorities trying to get ahead in America is a big enough thing to tackle, but I think Holly and the writers shot themselves in the foot by trying to get us invested in far too many characters and stories. Think of all the potentially compelling figures that ended up as getting shorter shrift than they deserved. Loy, Aretta, Ethel Rita, Satchel, Mike, or Satchel slash Mike, Wef, the Smutney family, Josto, Rabbi, all somewhat set up as main characters, so to speak. Any couple of them would have been compelling to focus on, but to me, at least, they spread the storyline in an often seemingly disconnected way amongst all of them, diluting the potential impact and making it difficult to invest the way we did in season 1. For example, when you had Lauren and Lester, they were the clear centerpieces, and people like the supermarket king never really threatened our ability to stay invested. In my mind, it also weakened the show's ability to drive home the ethical and moral points that we think this season was trying to raise, such as racial inequality, issues with current versions of American history, etc. Thoughts on this?
I'm trying to think, how big is the cast in season two? Is it pretty big?
I mean, you've got like
between the Gerhards
with multiple brothers and their children, and the matriarch, and then you've got
the Casey Mafia
rivals, and you got the Casey Mafia and the Kitchen Brothers, and you got Lou and his family and his extended family, and you've got Hanzi, which is part of that Gerhard clan.
It's pretty big.
It is pretty big.
I'd say seasons three and one are probably easily the smallest. Season two has a very big cast, and they did a great job on that.
Yeah.
You know, with minor exception, but.
Have you ever heard the term oppression Olympics, Jim?
No.
Okay, because this gets thrown around a lot. This is a term that came out of like late 70s feminism, but it's been most often used as like a way to decry identity politics. So it's like this idea that you get a room full of like feminists, Native Americans, Black people, Latino people, disabled people, white people, people that grew up in broken homes, people that have every privilege imaginable. You get all these people together. And then all points in between, right? Because you got Black disabled people and you got Native American women and
sure.
You got rich Black men, and you get all these points in between where all their issues intersect, and they all have legitimate issues with society. You know, who gets heard? Who gets to have a voice? Whose problems get taken priority? A lot of times these discussions get stereotyped into like, well, you know, let's find out who's the most oppressed and we'll begrudgingly listen to them because they'll just browbeat us into their, you know, because they're so fucking oppressed. The oppression Olympics.
Yeah.
But I think in another context, this would be a crazy thing to argue. Like if you're in an emergency room and you got like gunshot victims, people having heart attacks, cancer patients, somebody just needs stitches, and you got doctors and nurses with limited time and attention running around trying like, okay, who's the worst hurt? Who's got a time sensitive thing? And they're classifying it by all that kind of and taking people in turn. No one in that situation's like, the fuck is this? Some kind of health crisis Olympics? What's this bullshit trying to determine who needs the most help and who's got the most pressing need? And I feel like
that's why we have triage.
That's triage, right?
Like, yeah.
And you know, in an emergency room, when you're doing triage, especially after a big disaster, it's chaotic and it's noisy and it's messy, and the people are making mistakes and bad judgment, and people aren't honest completely in giving their medical in. People trying to game the system, right? Mm-hmm. But you can make pretty good TV out of that. Like, shit, ER was 12 seasons long of essentially just that. Like, look at how crazy this shit is. But you know, ER never tried to stuff a whole gang war like plot line in its an entire season.
That's,
you know,
the
like
thing.
I'm sure they had the gangbanger episode, and you know, Doug is there, like, oh my god, this is a mess, why are we killing each other? But it's not a whole season long, because you know what? ER wouldn't have the patience to focus on that kind of thing for that long. And I just wonder that's where I was going to this whole morality play, right? Like, what Hollywood's clearly interested in is this ER aspect of like, Josto had a point. It's bullshit the way his people were being treated.
Yeah.
Loy Cannon had a point. It's bullshit the way his people are being treated. Mm-hmm. Swanee had a point. It's bullshit the way her people have been historically treated and are still being treated. Who gets the most spotlight? Who gets to win the arguments? That's a messy, chaotic, noisy process, and then you're going to stuff it all within the framing of a gang war that people have conventional thoughts of how should go and are invested in that. And you know, how the hell do you do that? You know, and now you've and all Holly clearly wants to talk about this stuff, and all he's got is a vehicle, is Fargo, to drive around in. So you got this kind of chaotic story that was interesting, but it itself wasn't as interested in the centerpiece of the thing, which was the gang war,
right?
So,
and you know, the centerpiece being the murders, right? In previous seasons have always been a pretty small scale thing to center around. and this is a much larger scale thing. I bring up season two and its large cast of characters to simply point out that, like, it's not the number of characters that does it, right? It's the number of themes that you're going for, the number of messages you're trying to convey to the audience. And
right.
That's where things get tricky in the writing. Because you can have, 15 characters that each get a scene to characterize them, and then we know them, but they all are working toward a common goal. This one felt like, man, there are 15 different moving parts and 15 things that he's trying to say about society in each scene. And we're getting it, but because you're not able to really focus enough time on any one thing, it doesn't feel as cohesive as it needs to.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I feel that earlier feedback that said, like, Deffy could have been that character, but
Deffy's another wrinkle. Yeah,
and that's the thing. It's like, so you need like a morally neutral. Like, if you could have an alien land on Earth as a marshal and be like, all right, fucking Italians, people, Native Americans, let's. I'm gonna be. But are you going to, like, I was thinking, like, what if you cast like a native, like this, like, bitter Native American cop that happened to be a marshal and he or she's trying to figure all this shit out. But I'm like, well, they're not from a neutral frame, No. So what they did is they had like a waspy guy who's clearly like the villain playing that. So like, he hates everybody kind of that's not like him, and that kind of worked, but it also kind of didn't, because he's an antagonist towards everyone essentially. So I don't know.
And by casting Raylan Givens, by casting Seth Bullock in that role, they're sort of bringing another element of, like, the Wild West and the sheriff and the outlaw, and like, that's another thing. Don't forget, Swanee and Zalmer, like, the outlaws, right, are another wrinkle. And the fact that Swanee is a Native American is another fucking wrinkle. And like, yeah, it's going to feel hodgepodge. It's going to feel like too much is going on, because too much is going on. And I don't think it's the number of characters, though. It's the number of topics that he's approaching.
So that's the broad stroke. Eric continued with a more narrow focus question. The specific one is, during the podcast covering Story Americana, you touched on the idea that Loy was supposed to present as a competent one amongst fools, and this justified the casting of Jason Schwartzman, as Josto wasn't supposed to be the most serious character. I don't know that I view Loy as all that competent, though. I appreciate they set him up as a gangster with a moral compass. But you can't be a competent gangster and have a moral compass. Can you imagine Tony Soprano reacting in a measured and thoughtful way to a rival crew killing Anthony, or letting the equivalent of Gaetano walk free, or letting the equivalent of Josto or Ebel walk away without telling him his son was dead? Loy is creative and clearly ahead of his time, sure, but in terms of execution, he wasn't effective. Could better leadership for his faction have changed the outcome? Probably not, but a more competent Loy would have been better driven home their point about the inability of bright minority minds to get ahead, I think. I also wonder if casting Chris Rock in that role hurt that narrative. He had some great moments, but I wonder if the casting someone with more gravitas and dramatic chops would have, again, done more to counter Schwartzman's fumbling portrayal of Josto to drive home the theme of the uphill battle faced by the black community in America. Thanks again for my money. You guys are the best TV podcasters around, and I appreciate your work. Thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
What do you think about this?
I think he's right. Chris Rock never quite got there for me. I don't think he was bad, and like you said, he did have his moments. But yeah, let's put fucking anybody else in this role. Let's put Idris Elba. Let's put fucking I don't know, Denzel Washington from American Gangster in this role, right? Sure, tons of gravitas. Right. Holy shit, this guy's leaking gravitas out his ears. The plot still is not there to make him look like a badass, because he does lose in the end. He also takes several calculated risks that do not pay off, like releasing Gaetano. He thought that this was going to cause, a shitstorm within the Italian gang, and it doesn't. Like, none of his plans go off the way he wants them to, and that makes him look foolish. So no matter who you've got in that role, they're going to look foolish. They're going to look a little less than.
Yeah. And I think that's possibly part of the point that Holly's making, because, you know, we talked about this in a previous episode about, like, you know, a lot of times you hear, like, well, you know, if black people did this or that, they would have an easier chance if they, like, dressed a certain way or looked more respectable or did all this stuff. And then you look at, like, you know, in the actual 50s and 60s at a height of the civil rights, where you had people, like, very respectable, serious minded yeah. folks in their Sunday best marching mm-hmm. and getting dogs sicked on them and getting batoned and beat down in the streets. And I saw on Twitter someone passing around a survey, I think it was from 1961, asking white folks about whether black protests did more harm than good for the civil rights movement. And 85% of white respondents said it did more harm than good. Of course, wow. 50 years, 60 years down the road, we see that that was just bullshit. Like, yeah. there's no form of protest that a black person could do in that time that would have been seen as acceptable by the white community, and yet progress was made. So, like, is it possible that, like, a more badass or competent or gravitas black actor could have sold this story? Perhaps, but also, is it part of the thing that's like, you know, this guy's essentially Vito Corleone being played by Chris Rock, and that wasn't good enough. So yeah, this all good questions, though. All good mm-hmm. questions to consider. Next up, we got BR in Milwaukee. I, like the two of you, was disappointed in this season of Fargo. While still better than most shows, it wasn't at the level of the first two seasons or even the third. I did enjoy, however, the finale much more than the Bald Move peeps did. Which leads me to two questions. What is a chronological order of the four seasons in case I want to watch the other three in order? And who are your two favorite characters this year? Mine are Rabbi Milligan and Nurse Mayflower. Take the first one, because it's easy to answer.
4-2-1-3? Is that right?
You got
4-2-3-1. Okay.
You got it. Season 1's 2006. Season 2 is set in 1979. Season 3 is set in 2010. And season 4 is 1950. So now I will say that I don't know that's necessarily the order that you should watch things in. Because this is always a big debate about, like, which, you know, if you got a kid that hasn't seen Star Wars, which do you show them the prequels first and then the sequels, right. and then, or do you show them like 1, 2, and then you pause and do, you know, Empire, you know, the New Hope Empire, and then you do 3, then Return of the Jedi. Like, it's all kinds of stuff. Like, it's a different experience, and you can only have the experience once, you know, like. Broadcast airing is not an invalid way to watch a series. For certain.
I show them The Mandalorian first, and then I show them Return of the Jedi, and they get so disappointed.
You really want to fuck with them, yeah. Look at this badass. He's what's going to happen to him? As far as the favorite character, Rabbi Milligan was really great. I really liked him, but yeah. I got to throw in my love behind Dr. Senator.
Hell yeah.
He was an amazing character, and honestly, that was a real blow, I think, to the series. They needed to kill him when he did. I'm not great, but it was a real moment. It really bummed me out because he was so amazing. Mm-hmm. Nurse Mayflower, like, her the physical performance of this role,
yeah.
and the committing to this really, you know, type this particular type of uptight asshole, I thought was pretty entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your favorites?
I mean, Milligan is I don't know, for me, like, favorite character or favorite portrayal of a character, because, like, Weff, man, Houston does an amazing job with Weff. Mm. I think he's fantastic, as he always is. And then, you know, Jesse Buckley as Orietta is outstanding as well. Like, my favorite character is probably Rabbi Milligan.
I thought with the first few episodes it was going to be Ethel Rita, no doubt. But I feel like that,
yeah,
they really, boy, the middle part of that season just shelved her.
Yeah.
Kind of took the narrative away from her, and they brought it back around in the end. Man, It's one of those things where it's like, it'd be an interesting experiment to take the raw footage of this season and like recut, especially the middle pieces, to see if you can get, you know, bring some of that stuff more to the forefront. Because the framing device of her writing a history on America, from her point of view, I think was really interesting. And I don't, by the final episode, I'd forgot about that device.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's a way you could cut some of the stuff that turns out not to matter as much and focus on that somehow.
Maybe tighten up the season. The other honorable mention here is Swanee. I really like Swanee. She doesn't get a ton of time, but the stuff she does get is fantastic.
Yeah, Swanee and Zelmer, another ones that were like, I thought, crowd pleasers as far as their larger than life performance and the impact they had on the show. And just they get closed out. And I guess Deffy, you could throw in that same pile. They got closed out in dramatic fashion. And then is this kind of a stinger for the end of the series, Zelmer? So, but yeah, hopefully that answers your questions. Moving on to Danielle, I'm a brand new viewer of this show. I've never seen the movie or the previous three seasons, but I was drawn into this season by the Hulu promo with Chris Rock and the pandemic binging. Of course, it brings in a lot of people. Having no prior experience with the universe of characters, I really enjoyed the season overall. The math line from Rabbi Milligan is now an essential refrain I sprinkle in conversations from time to time. his views on math in particular, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
It did make sense on the episode 11 podcast when I think it was Jim said that he liked the parts better than the whole. I felt like some things were a little truncated as the season plugged along. Lloyd's story was definitely a display of how black people have to work twice as hard to get half as much. Basically, regardless of how much smarter we are, how much harder we work, there's always a possibility that whiteness will deny us progress. I really thought that he was going to make it, and his final gasp on the porch felt like a real punch to the gut. It's interesting because hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I've heard a lot from like black folks on this podcast and like Native American folks, unfortunately in the last category, more stuff I was doing wrong than right, but hell, I appreciate learning all the same. I think that's interesting that like, well, it's not interesting. It's kind of obvious that like some of this stuff would speak to them. Like for example, the one that I got the most feedback on was like Loy seeing the credit card billboard. And just like the bone wariness of like, God damn, you know, whitey doing it again.
Another thing taken from. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Appropriated. It's interesting to have those different perspectives. And that's the other thing. It's like, you know, if what doesn't speak to me or Jim or other people might be like, The Leftovers is a perfect example of a show that didn't resonate with a lot of people, but god damn, it felt like it was made for me and to resonate particularly with me. So, and I like the chance the Bald Move gives us, I guess, because we give ourselves a chance to cover shows like nichier shows like that, you know, Leftovers and Fargo. She continues, I do feel that Ethel Rita was especially wasted. I'm going to blame it on the pandemic. I almost felt like she was operating in a totally different show. Man, that's why I was really hoping for one of those multi-page, hour-long podcasts where Noah Hawley would just talk about all the fucking pain and angst of this season, because it's got to be.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm blowing it out of proportion. I don't know. It just seems like if you really squint and look, there's something a lot grander than what actually made it to the screen here.
Mm-hmm.
She continues, I'm now four episodes into season two because I was especially intrigued by Satchel becoming Mike Milligan and had to see him in action as an adult. The short clip of Bokeem Woodbine really hooked me because I had no idea he was a part of this universe. I remember him from Jason's Lyric, which is a deep cut from my high school days, but a classic nonetheless. I'm in the middle of episode four pod and I stopped to send this email. After I finish the season, I'm going to start season one and finally wrap up a season three. I'm looking forward to uncovering additional connections between the seasons. That's a lot of fun of this show. It's unexpected because, like, when Fargo began, I never thought that there would be all these connections to kind of run through. But really, it's season three is kind of on of its own little island. Everything else is very connected, as it turns out.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to, like, season one when we were watching it and we were like, oh, the big connection here is the bag of money, right? Like,
right, to the Fargo film.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So we were looking for those connections, and I don't think there are a ton of connections, but there's enough to see that, oh, these are bones are all part of this one skeleton.
They're Easter eggs is what they happen to be. Except for that, yeah. I feel like it can't help but inform your understanding of Mike Milligan to watch this season. Like,
for sure.
In a way. And I guess that's the same as true. Like, to understand Molly Salverson, you know, it added a lot to go back to season two and see how that kind of formed her into the policewoman she was. So, yeah, it kind of, maybe they've always been a little bit, but it's more like Easter egg stuff than anything. But anyway, Danielle concludes with a PS postscript. I'm a black woman from Kansas City. Aaron, I really enjoyed hearing your take on the race and whiteness that you mentioned on your Three Right Turns podcast, the unbearable whiteness episode that you mentioned during the first episode of the recap. Thank you for all your content. You're always giving me something else to consider about what I've watched. Yeah, I appreciate you checking that out, Danielle. And if anybody else is interested in the more political stuff, like the Suppression Olympics kind of stuff, I talk about that a lot over on Three Right Turns on the Swizzbold network, swizzbold.com. So check it out if you're inclined to. Then got a couple more. Dan says, hey guys, observation and a question. I was listening to your coverage of the last episode and it reminded me of a saying a long ago ex-girlfriend said to me, when the love is thin, the faults are many. She said this to me right before we mutually decided we should break up. So
that's the time to say it.
To stick with you.
Yeah.
My wife and I, oh, see, it's got a happy ending. My wife and I loved this season and all the Fargo seasons, even more so than Legion. And I think we're just in with Fargo. Maybe it's the vibe or the quirkiness or fun casting, whatever. Sure. Plus, we know the other one was having fun, which probably helps unconsciously. It's interesting to think about when we stop being along for that ride and start watching more skeptical. That's what happened for me in the past, such as in Game of Thrones last few seasons. When I start nitpicking things and I might not if I was still quote unquote in, like arguing the tactical intelligence of a headlong charge into White Walkers when you've made all those defenses, or in this case for you all wondering if the real or previous movie version Mafia Dons would really act like they did in certain circumstances. But my question for you is, beyond plot issues or the inability to coherently tell a powerful story about race, was there a moment you remember feeling like the show had lost you? It seemed like it was early, listening to the season recaps as they came out. I'm curious about why I like certain things and why others do, and how those opinions form and when they become strongly held to the point where they even change how we watch the shows. Thanks for Fargo recaps and happy holidays. Can I want to answer this feedback with another piece of feedback.
Okay.
I think it gets to the heart of both of our issues. Jeffrey says, I believe it was Aaron who agreed that if Gaetano would turn passive, that he would lose it. We have this guy who's a violent monster turned to a practical, conservative voice of reason with a little time devoted to change of character. I understand he was tortured, but would this not make him even more crazy and aggressive? This is where the show sort of lost me. I could handle the ghost, other strange turns, but it really did not get me what they were going for with this character. For me, the show lost a lot of credit at that point. That's me. Like, Dr. Senator was definitely a blow because I thought he was one of my favorite characters, but like...
Yeah.
And I think I fundamentally misunderstood something that Holly was trying to do with Gaetano, because I felt like I got yanked around three different directions in like three different episodes with the guy Gaetano, and I didn't like how he landed. Like, I just think he's a ridiculous character.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel like a real person or a real thing. And I had... And it's one thing if you have like a Lorne Malvo, like the unstoppable evil force that you're supposed to kind of understand as an alien. But this guy, you know, maybe it all tracks. If I had been an 11-year-old sent to fucking fascist Italy and, you know, as a 13-year-old on death squads for Il Duce, maybe I'd understand him. But...
That's a tough perspective to identify with, yeah.
I was an 11-year-old fucking Mafia Don's bosses shipped off to fascist Italy to fight in a bunch of, you know, communist purges and stuff. So, like, I had a hard time wrapping my head around this guy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I can see where... Oh, I'm sorry. I got in that final. I can see where he could be scary as an actor, but, yeah, yeah. Like, it just... He never got beyond an unserious buffoon.
I still definitely want to go watch Gamora. I hear great things about him in that. So maybe, you know, just this switch over to comedy wasn't the right role for that. I'm trying to pinpoint when it was. It was before Dr. Senator's death. It had to be, because that happened fairly late.
It was like season five, or episode five, rather.
Somewhere in there. I'm just having a hard time really pinpointing when it was. I'm not sure this season ever caught like a really good footing with me. I remember episode one being very entertained, and you know, seeing like, okay, this is a story I could get into. It's got an Italian mafia, which I love those stories. It's got a really capable set of, a mob boss, and then a consigliere in Loy and Dr. Senator. All that stuff is working really well for me, and it's somewhere along the line where I realized, okay, Schwartzman is not exactly what I expected this mafia boss to be, this new mafia boss. Chris Rock isn't exactly what I expect an actor to bring to his role. Something is not sitting right with me here. It was real early on, but it was never like, oh, this is the moment where I said, you know, I'm done. I'm not in on the show anymore.
I do think it gives us a glimpse of what The Godfather could have been like if Sonny and Fredo were running things, because like I had this in my notes to mention I didn't, because when Jason Schwartzman was in full whining like, I'm the boss, you have to listen, it reminded me of Fredo like berating Michael about, I'm smart, I can do things, like, god damn it, you've lived your whole life with evidence to the contrary, get the fuck out of here, sit down, Fredo.
Yeah, sit down in this boat, Fredo.
Exactly, for the final, yeah, and I just like, but you know what, I think that version of Godfather sucks.
Sure.
That's the version of Godfather is an intensely frustrating watch, and that's what the Italian side of this season felt like, just like, who am I rooting for here, Ebel? And then he's the one that's the dick of all dicks at the end. Like, imagine if Dr. Senator like helped like Loy, you know, fight his way to the king of Kansas City and then shivs him in the end and turns into a real shit. Like, I wouldn't enjoy that. And that's kind of what happened on the Italian side of this season was a fiasco, in my opinion.
With the exception of like, I liked a lot of the Calamita
fiasco
stuff.
In Italian, is that a good Italian term? Yeah, it's a fiasco. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I like some of the Calamita stuff. I also... really like the Rabbi Milligan stuff. There is some stuff to like on the Italian side.
The fart attack.
And I was definitely still on board when, the fart attack is excellent, but Rabbi Milligan gives his math speech. But that must have been episode two or three. Like it feels like that was really early on. So I don't know.
Finally, Vince wraps it up. Hey guys, been a big fan of your podcast since I found you after the second season of Fargo. Interesting. And have been listening ever since. My question is, you two had major issues with the nature of how the UFO is essentially a deus ex machina to save Lou from Bear at the massacre of season two. Similarly, this season, Mr. Snowman shows up in the penultimate episode and directly interferes with Mayflower's attempt to kill Ethel Rita. Why didn't you have the same reaction to the supernatural element of this season saving the protagonist from the bad guy?
I think it's because
this is a good question. And I've got some good answers for it. What do you think, Jim?
For me, it was that the supernatural element didn't come out of nowhere. In that season, it just drops out of the sky, literally drops out of the sky. And I didn't see any of that coming. Whereas Mr. Snowman had been a character on screen for multiple episodes, and I knew that he was around, lurking, and I thought, okay, well, that happens because this is a character in the show, like any other. If Lloyd Cannon had walked up behind her and said, "Don't do it," you're gonna be in trouble if you do this, or Josto, came up and said, "Hey, we got to go back to the bed. I need some whipping or something."
Mm-hmm.
It would have felt, very similar to the Mr. Snowman walking in and stopping it. So to me, it's all about, like, was I warmed up for this thing? And absolutely, I was warmed up for it in this season.
And it's like, I think that's most of it right there, because it's not that they didn't ever hint that there was some UFO stuff. Like, I remember in the first episode of season two, there was something that looked like a UFO, but it could have been headlights or imagine, like, okay, same thing. We saw Mr. Snowman in episode one of Fargo this season. He was standing in the middle of the street outside Ethel Rita's house. Imagine that's the only time we'd seen Mr. Snowman until he shows up to save her.
I would have been, what the fuck is this?
Right. But, like, it wasn't as, and also it's just not as high stakes. Like, Ethel Rita versus Orietta was not, was not like a gang war interrupted by a UFO, in my opinion. And the other thing is just that, like, also this, the other thing is I remember us having this discussion about, like, what if ghosts on Fargo? And my opinion is, like, you know what? After four seasons on the Fishnado and the UFO and the teasing of the UFO and then Jewish Bowling Heaven or whatever we got in season three, yeah. It's like, Fargo's going to pull this shit and I'm going to be ready. I'm more ready for it now, too. But I also think it was a better developed. So, but that's the thing. If they hit me with season two Fargo now, like if season five was season two and we already had the ghost and we already had the Jewish Bowling Heaven in the middle of the woods or we had the Fishnado, I think I would have taken a little bit more in stride too. So it's a combination.
Just like think back to season two and our coverage. We weren't talking about, oh, when is the UFO going to come? What is the meaning of the UFO and when is it going to come back into play? And like, how's it going to affect the story and our characters? In this season, we were absolutely talking about Mr.
Every
Snowman
single time,
throughout.
It's like,
so,
and even the, I was an early proponent of, like, I bet it's a guardian spirit. And I don't know if it's exactly that, but it's kind of the way. So like, those questions were being asked and, like I said, it's not that there was no UFO talk in season two, but no one on the Fargo threads and our feedback or anyone is like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is this fucking UFO is just going to drop out of the sky, Close Encounter style, and bring to a halt this massive orgy of violence they've promised us all season long and even talked about last season has been a particularly gruesome orgy of violence. Yeah. So it's like, whereas the Mr. Snowman stuff actually did feel very built up to and almost inevitable. So anyway, that's it. That's our talk for Fargo. We're putting it to bed. Again, I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to Bald Move Premium. That's where all of our please subscribe to Bald Move Premium. We could use your support. support.baldmove.com. Bald Move Prestige is where it's essentially a feed where all of our prestige content, films, stuff that isn't about ghosts or UFOs or biblical plague tornadoes, that kind of stuff,
laser beams.
If you like gangster stuff, if you like more emotionally grounded, realistic work, award-winning work. That's where you find it, Bald Move Prestige. And I think you'd enjoy most of our coverage there. And there's going to be, like I said, some good stuff upcoming this year. And also, Tom Cruise's Castaway. It's a great movie. We're going to talk about it.
Tom Cruise, excellent in Castaway.
Did I say Tom Cruise? Jesus. The way he runs on the beach.
In sand, no less.
Tom Hanks. The Tom Cruise of Tom Hanks's in Castaway. We also did one on Misery, which was, I thought was pretty, last week was pretty good. So good stuff. And also we're in the middle of the Christmas season. If you want to celebrate Christmas with us, we got a lot of good stuff going out that you can get in by going to christmas.baldmove.com. But that's where we're going to leave you for the season. Have a great rest of 2020 if you can. Hopefully 2021 will be a lot better for a lot of us. At least we'll get this goddamn pandemic put to bed, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And Merry Christmas to everybody. And like I said, hopefully we'll see a lot more of you in the new year. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.